Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks, on this wet and windy Sydney night, and Anna Bligh makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She's well known to all of you here, but I'll introduce her briefly. In March 2009, Anna Bligh made history when she became the first woman to lead a party to victory in a state election in Australia. She was born in Queensland, grew up mainly on the Gold Coast, and graduated from the University of Queensland. She's worked in the community sector and trade unions and in public service before entering Parliament, where she had a distinguished career before becoming the Premier of Queensland. I think the last time Ms. Bligh addressed the Institute was shortly after the Queensland floods, which as Premier she handled so well. And after losing the election in 2002, Anna Bligh stepped down from politics and is now living and working in Sydney as the CEO of the YMCA New South Wales, but also as an author. And she's here on the occasion of the publication of her book, Anna Bligh, Through the Wall, Reflections on Leadership, Love and Survival. And she's going to talk to us broadly on that topic tonight. Anna Bligh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jared, for that introduction and for the invitation to join yourself and members of the Sydney Institute. Jared is right, I am not a stranger to the Institute. I did address the Institute in 2011. On that occasion, I was staying in Woolloomooloo and it started pouring with rain. I got a cab at 20 past five, expecting to be here well in time. An hour later, I was still on College Street and had to get out of the cab in the rain and walk several blocks to make it, and was late. And some of you I know were here on that occasion. So when I saw all the blustery weather today, I thought there must be something about the combination of Anna Bligh and Jared Henderson that offends the gods, or something, because the skies have opened on both occasions. So I'm delighted to not be in that circumstance this evening. As many of you will know, there is a plethora of political biographies currently weighing down the shelves of Australian bookshops, and I think it's reasonable for you to ask, why would someone want to add another one to that groaning pile? I was not particularly interested in writing a standard political biography. I think the record of my time in government and in politics is well known and already much written about and commented on, and I didn't feel the need to add to that record. So this is not a political biography in which you will find a lot of salacious political gossip, and I've said in the book, if you're looking for that, you should put the book back on the shelf. I've also said that those who have conspired against me who betrayed me, or who have conspired with me against others, can all relax. This is not a book that will be betraying secrets. This book is very much a personal reflection on the personal lived experience of leadership. I was approached by HarperCollins to write a book that was of a much more personal nature, to reflect on my own experience and to share that personal experience in a way that perhaps is not so common in political memoirs or writing. So that's what I set out to do. I was interested in the approach from HarperCollins because I did think it was something that perhaps did add something to the broad record of what it is like to have a political career in the public life of our country. The book also attempts to answer one of the most common questions that is put to me by people who talk to me about my experiences in politics and public life, and those are those very personal questions. What is it like to be in a position like that? What does it feel like when you have to confront those really big choices and decisions? How do you feel when people are protesting against you? What was it like when you had to make those decisions in the flood? So I've tried to capture, as I've said, that lived experience. And in my experience of leadership at the most senior political levels, leadership is not a normal life. It is a life in which you have to be driven, you have to have very healthy doses of ambition and have a very clear understanding of the goal that you want to achieve. With very rare exception, that you don't end up running this country or running one of the states of Australia by accident, and you certainly don't, that doesn't happen to you if you are a woman at this particular point in history. I think we all know that leadership demands strength and courage and endurance. It requires vision. It requires that sense of looking over the next horizon and the ability to inspire people to come with you on the journey. But it also requires a certain doggedness and a great deal of energy. While this book is not a full biography, it's not a standard political biography, nor is it a full and comprehensive biography of my life. I didn't set out to do that either. But it was not possible, as I started to write the book, to reflect on the choices that I made that led me into that life of politics and into public life and into senior and more senior positions, without also reflecting on some of the forces that formed me. What made me decide to put my hand up for these jobs? What was it that drew me to an interest in politics, to the particular side of politics that I chose, and what is it about my early childhood and some of the other forces in my life, like Catholicism, that helped to shape me into the person that ultimately put their hand up for what was a very big job and had to jump some very big hurdles to get there. So the book does reflect on the role of adversity and the role of failure in forming leaders, informing the sort of resilience and ability to get back on the horse that you will find, I think, common among all leaders, whether they're in leading the corporate world or in the political world and on either and both sides of politics. Many of you will have formed your views of me from the very extensive television coverage during those extended floods and disasters that Queensland experienced so catastrophically in 2011. Those, I think, disasters became quite etched in the minds of and in the feelings of Australians, because they were protracted. They went for almost 6 weeks. Every time we thought that they were getting better and we were getting over them, they seemed to get worse. And I felt that the rest of the country, while you may not be personally affected, many people knew people who were affected, many people had relatives and families. And we all got caught up with it a bit, because it was January, the television stations switched their summer programming to constant coverage. They were extraordinary images of what Mother Nature is capable of, and every time you thought you could never see anything more horrifying, there would be another image the next day that captured us all again. So it was a very big experience in Queensland. It was a very big experience for me, but it was also an experience that I think the whole country got caught up in at various points. For me, that was an extraordinary lesson in leadership. It was not the first time I had faced a disaster. Queensland is a tropical state, and I'd had, as Premier and in other positions, faced minor flooding of a very different nature in smaller towns a number of times during the time that I had been in politics. But I had certainly never faced anything that size, but nor had our senior emergency team, and nor had any emergency services around the country such a broad, extended experience over such a very long period of time. It meant that we had to not only manage the event and make the decisions necessary to manage it, but it was an experience that very quickly became one that demanded a different kind of leadership. And I could physically feel the expectations of me changing. You could feel the public looking for something that perhaps we don't look for very often from political leaders. And it's almost as if in political leadership in Australia, you are very conscious that our electorate, the public, I think don't like to see their leaders get too far away from the lives that are lived by most Australians. And part of that is the way that we talk about what we do. The Australian community, in my experience, and I think it's the experience of most other political leaders, does not really give you permission very often to be speaking in high and relatively lofty terms. I think the American community is much more, it has much higher expectations that their president will get up every day and give something like the Gettysburg Address. It's what they expect, and they're very comfortable when their president speaks in those terms. That's not really an Australian characteristic. But there are moments, and they came, for example, very early in John Howard's prime ministership with the Port Arthur massacre, when the whole country looks for a certain shift and a certain lift in the nature of leadership. And that moment certainly came for me during those terrible disasters. And so one of the things I reflect on in the book is, what was it about those moments that drove those expectations and almost a hunger in the community for a different kind of leadership? For one, and I could feel the community almost giving me permission to speak in a way and to act in a way and to talk to them in a way that was quite different because of the very different nature of those circumstances. It was a moment where I think we all shared a common vulnerability and a common humanity, and in those circumstances, bipartisanship very quickly rushes to the fore. Party politics disappear very quickly, and people are looking for something very different in the public leadership of the event. In reflecting on leadership generally in the book, I have touched on some moments in my own leadership journey, which I think are very common to the leadership journey of all people, everyone who experiences it. You might deal with those moments differently, but I think there are some very common milestones. And one of those is what I would say is the moment when you are starting to emerge as a leader. You are starting to move in a direction that's different to your peers. You are being promoted at work. You're being singled out for as the person who should get the opportunities. You are being noticed in the political environment. The media is starting to take note of what you say. The profiles about you start appearing. And as that starts to happen, you start to feel yourself physically separating. I call it separating from the herd. And we are pack animals. We're very comfortable in the herd. It's a very warm and recognised and comfortable place. And I think for every person who starts a journey towards leadership, there is a moment when you physically can feel yourself and emotionally feel yourself separating. People who have been up until that point, your colleagues, your peers and your friends, suddenly start to see you differently. They've actually felt you move past them. And for some of them, they will resent that and you will feel that. They will start asking questions. How come you're getting that opportunity? Why were you picked for that? Why are the media writing about you? Why is the boss, picking you for this chance? And for many people, and I've seen it happen in politics and I'm sure it happens in the corporate world, as you go through that moment, it's a very uncomfortable moment. And I have seen people go through it and then decide that's actually not for them. They actually want to retreat and they like the comfort of the herd. And there's nothing wrong with that. But you cannot keep going into the more senior positions and taking on those leadership roles unless you find a way of getting comfortable outside of the herd. And for me, that was very much a debate I had with myself and others had with me about ambition. Obviously, when I'm reflecting on leadership in the book, I do so from a very female perspective. I only know one way of doing that. When I was sworn in as Premier, the most common question I got in the first 48 hours from the media, constantly in almost every interview, was, what do you think it's going to be like doing it as a woman? And I said, I don't know. I haven't done it the other way. how do you think it's going to be different? And I didn't. I couldn't answer the question. But I don't think that... I think for many women, reconciling ambition with femininity, with their femininity, is still something that they struggle with and are very uncomfortable with. And I certainly had to face that in myself and decide very clearly and very explicitly that I did have ambition, that I thought it was actually a good thing, not a bad thing, and that I could and would own it. And I think and I put the point in the book that those people who can't do that, who are unable to own that ambition, will struggle if they are seeking to lead others. I don't want to see, the leader of my nation or the leader of my state, and no secret, and they wouldn't be surprised to know that I didn't vote for either of them, but I want Tony Abbott to be someone of ambition for my country. I want the leader of New South Wales to be someone who is ambitious. I think we all want to see that in our leaders, regardless of whether they're from our side of politics or not. So it is an issue that I think many women still struggle with, and one that I've explored a little in the book. I also talk about those moments when the responsibility and the mantle of leadership, when you feel it very physically, you can feel it's the weight of it settle on your shoulders, and where you are thrown into a circumstance when a grenade flies in from left field, where neither you've dealt with it before, and nor have some of the senior people around you. And there might be only one or two people with a little bit of expertise. And you have to pull together all of the facts that you've got, and you have a very short window in which you have to make decisions. And you can't continue to research, you can't phone a friend, you actually have to be the one that makes the call. And how is it that you come to that moment? For me, and I think for many others, the best word I can think of to describe that experience is that absolutely when you've got to make the call, you rely on what I call instinct. And instinct's a very difficult thing to define, but in my experience, it is the culmination of all of the layers that life has laid down in you in the years and years leading up to those moments. And many of those layers of life are laid down not in the political realm, not in the corporate realm, not in the realm of work. They are actually laid down in your personal life. I think there is a lot of, you will have certainly heard a lot of talk about the sorts of characteristics that particularly male leaders have because of their experiences on the sporting field. I think that is an absolutely important experience. I'm the mother of two sons. I have watched those boys learn things on the sporting field about themselves, about their capability, about their peers, about teamwork that I could never have taught them at home by myself. The sporting field is a place where we learn leadership skills and we learn capability and we learn resilience. But there are many other parts of our lives where we learn those things, and they are often deeply personal experiences. And I think we often don't realise how much those experiences are grounding us for much harder decisions or much bigger decisions, perhaps not harder, in other parts of our lives. And particularly for women, I think we need to find a language that gives us a way of talking about those experiences that also speaks to the development of strength, resilience and agility in our corporate political leadership roles. So I talk, for example, about the experiences I had as a young mother dealing with very, very sick babies, and how the going through those moments, how conscious I was at the end of them, of what it was that I and my family had just lived through, and understanding that I had actually gained something, and that a sense that if I can do that, if I can go through that, if I can make the calls that had to be made then, I can do other big things. And actually trusting that experience and relying on it when those calls came at a later time. The book I also try to be very honest about the nature of politics, and that is that it's a very ruthless business, and that means it has some terrific highs and some awful lows. And in my experience, people never ask me, what was it like to win? I think we can all imagine that that's a great feeling. But people are intrigued by what it feels like to lose. And so people often ask me, what was it like to lose that election? As if I really wanted to keep reliving the experience. But I accept that people are naturally curious about this, because what they see is that it's not just that you've lost a promotion at work. It is a very big public failure or loss, and people are curious about how you deal with that, because it is part of the role of political leadership. There are some political leaders in this country who happen to be at the right point in the political cycle who have the opportunity to leave politics at a time of their own choosing. But for all the rest of us, and we are the overwhelming majority, your job is not only to win, but at some point you have to confront the reality that you will also have to go down with the ship. And it's a pretty tough thing to think about. So I try to be very explicit and honest about that. I did actually go and look at some other political biographies of people who'd had pretty big losses, and they've sort of said, oh yes, and then I lost the election and moving right along. And I can understand why that happens, because it's not something you want to explore, and it's not something I found that chapter quite difficult to write about. But I did so because people are very interested. And I do worry sometimes that one of the things that discourages young people from entering politics or from contemplating a life in which they might take on a role of political leadership is that prospect that your losses and your failures are writ very, very large. And that can be a very daunting and overwhelming thing to contemplate. So I do think it's important to explore that. In my experience, again, going back to early life, probably one of the best things that ever happened to me, while I was at university, I decided to run as president of the student union. I lost, and I was 21 at the time. While we were running the campaign, we had a great time. There was lots of fun, lots of hard work, lots of people working together late into the night, putting up posters, you know, all the things that happen on a university campus. I had not for 1 minute contemplated what it would feel like if I lost. And it was an absolutely devastating impact. We all think we're very grown up when we're 21, but I was still a very young person with not a lot of that kind of life experience. And I really thought I would never recover from it. It seemed such a public defeat. But I realised very quickly, literally within a week, that the people who loved me still loved me, that I was in fact still the same person, that everyone else had got on with their lives, that friends were still calling, and in fact my life had not changed very much at all. And it was a very powerful lesson that you can get back up, you can get on the horse. And I think, you know, when you look at very strong leaders, wherever you see them, I always think they are the people who know how to get back up on the horse, because you can't be a leader without taking risks, and every time you take a risk there's a chance you're going to fall off the horse. So those early experiences of failure were for me critical in that leadership journey. The title of the book refers to the recurring theme, and that is, as I mentioned before, that when I contemplate leadership, I try to look for those lessons that are as general as possible. But there is an experience right now at this point in history of being a woman in that sort of public leadership. And I do reflect on that experience as a recurring theme in the book. I was, as Jared said in the introduction, the first woman Premier of Queensland, and one of only, at that point, only a handful of women who had been in positions of political leadership in Australia. I'm sure there are people in this audience who are Aaron Sorkin fans. If you love the dialogue of West Wing, you might have seen a movie called Moneyball, which Aaron Sorkin also made. And it's about a baseball team in America where the coach is trying to turn the game of baseball on its head, and in doing so incurs the wrath of the baseball establishment. And he's bemoaning this to a mate, to a friend, who says, in essence, tells him to get over himself, but says the first one through the wall always gets bloody, always. And it struck me as a very powerful metaphor for anybody who is pioneering. If you're an entrepreneur trying to get people to, you know, think about something in a completely different way, you will get bloody as you challenge the status quo and as you challenge the incumbents. If you are a woman in what has been a very male-dominated political and parliamentary environment in Australia, then you are going to get a few scratches and bruises as you make your way through that wall. But what strikes me is how often I am asked by young women whether or not, having watched what they see happening to Julia Gillard, what they see happening to myself and other women leaders, whether or not I would advise any young woman in this country to put their hand up. And I, without hesitation, say absolutely, because I don't want them to look at the bruises or the scratches that I might have got as I made my way through the wall. I want them to see the hole in the wall. And I want them to understand that every single time another woman goes through that hole, it's going to get bigger, and it's going to fall down. It's going to stop being... We are not that far away, I think, from women in politics ceasing to be a novelty or unusual or the exception. And that has happened in a relatively short period of time, a blink of an eye. In the last 50 years in this country, we have lived through the largest, and in Western developed industrial countries around the world, We have lived through the single largest movement of women out of the private domestic sphere into the public world of work and decision making ever in human history. And it has happened at an unbelievably accelerated rate. For many of us, it's taken our whole lifetime. But when historians look back in 200 years' time, that shift is going to seem to them, from that vantage of history, as one of the most striking things about the last 50 years of the 20th century. And that rapid and accelerated shift is changing everything. It's changing workplaces, it's changing economies, it is changing social structures, it's changing family sizes and shapes, it's changing relationships between men and women, and it's changing our democracy. It is changing the shape and the feel of the public life of our country. But it is still a relatively rare phenomenon, and it does mean that I think the jury is still out on what kind of leaders women make and whether having women in positions of leadership in fact makes any difference at all. It is, because it is a novelty, there is and continues to be a very genuine curiosity about it. I have a curiosity about it. I am interested in, you know, watching how Julie Bishop is managing on the world stage. I am curious about how, you know, Gladys is going to go in her new portfolio. You know, this is still, you know, unusual enough for us to be curious about how it will go. But as we see more and more, as we are already seeing, women move into those roles, we are going to see that novelty and that curiosity wear off. I think the curiosity is an entirely normal and natural human response. As I said, I have it myself. But what it means for the women who are on the receiving end of it, and I know from my own experience, is that you are never free of your gender. You are a woman premier. You are a woman politician. And there is, as I say, nothing wrong with that when you're a first. But what I'm hoping for is that in the not too distant future, we won't see the gender of our politicians. We will see their performance and we'll mark them accordingly. Not quite there yet, but I do note that in my home state of Queensland, with the election of Anastasia Palaszczuk, Queensland has become the first state in the Federation to elect a second woman leader. And there is no doubt that when you are struggling and fighting and working for social change, wherever that campaign is waged, firsts are really important. Firsts challenge the status quo and make all of us take notice about, oh, that maybe that can be done differently. But it's the second and the third and the fourth that really entrench equality, because it's with the second and the third and the fourth and the ones after that that you start to move from novelty to normal. And I do think, as I said, with the accelerated rate of women in senior positions that we're now seeing, we are starting to move from novelty to normal. Early on in the book, I quote Anais Nin, who said, "We write to taste life twice, once in the living and once in the retrospection." And there is a bit of that in the book as I relive some of the highs and the lows and try to give you a sense not only of what it was like to live in that public moment, but also to make the point that leadership and politics is a profoundly human business. And there are moments that you will all know from seeing the images on television or reading about it in newspapers, around which there were all kinds of other personal circumstances and a very human side to what was going on. And much of what happens behind the scenes or in the opportunities you have in those positions to meet so many members of the public is very emotionally charged, but can often also be very, very humorous. So I'm going to end my formal comments with one of the stories in the book that really touched me and brought home to me how important it is, and I think particularly in an Australian context we use this a lot, how important humour is when you are facing trauma and catastrophe, and how it can really make something that seems unbearable just a little bit more bearable for a moment. You will all recall that during the worst of those floods, we had a terrible event in Toowoomba where you will have seen those swift water rescues in the main street, cars floating in mud, terrible images of children on the top of the roofs of cars waiting to be rescued. And then the wall of water swept through the valley and took out a whole little town called Grantham, and almost every house in the town was washed away. And the people of the town, those that survived, were evacuated to a local church hall about 10 k's away from their town. And their town was sealed off as a crime scene while the police searched for survivors and those who didn't survive. I visited the evacuation centre as soon as it was possible to get in there, just on 48 hours after this event. If you can imagine, this is one of the most traumatic, this is absolute trauma. People have been literally, a wave of water has washed them out of their houses. They've watched their neighbours' houses floating past them with their neighbours screaming, and they can't help them. And so very, very deeply traumatic experience. So I was in the evacuation centre. I was talking to a man, an elderly gentleman, and I said to him, "And what's your name?" And he tried to say something to me, and as he did, he just began to weep, and tears were flowing down his face, and he couldn't speak. And a woman walked up, and I couldn't help but notice she had no teeth, and she grabbed his hand, and she said, "Premier, this is my husband. We had less than 2 minutes to get out of the house, and I had to make a choice whether I would go back for my teeth or get my husband out." And luckily she was holding his hand at this point. She said, "And right now I'm not sure if I made the right decision." And it was obviously a long and strong marriage because he just burst into laughter. It was one of those moments where you can say those sorts of things in a close relationship, and suddenly it just brought happiness to his face just for a moment, and he could talk to me about some of the things that he'd experienced. And I just thought, what a powerful little moment that this woman had given back to her husband after such a terrible event. There are many other humorous stories about how people cope with those disasters in the pages of the book. So I hope that in this book I have given people a taste of what it's like to live that public life that you see, and some of the more personal and private aspects of it. And I hope that some of the comments I've made tonight give you some food for thought, and I look forward to your questions and comments. Thank you.
Many thanks, Anna Blaby. May get you a glass of water, and then we come to question and discussion. I should say, Janet Grundy down the back's got copies of Anna Blaby Through the Wall, Reflections on Leadership, Love and Survival, and I'm sure Miss Blaby would be happy to sign any of them after the event. And so we now come to questions and discussion, and we'll conclude around the top of the aisle. Thanks, Anne. Anne, you may take one of these. Tell us a bit, I know it's in your book, but a bit about yourself. I think there's only two Blys that made an impact on Australia. One of them is the other guy had a bit of a trouble down the road here at the time of the Rum Rebellion, and the other one is you. But your background seems fairly conservative. I think you've got Sisters of Mercy, then you go to the Star of the Sea. Is that the Presentation Nuns, is that right?
No, still
Sisters of Mercy. Still Sisters of Mercy, see, there you go. I'm losing it. And then you go to university and you become a bit of a lefty radical, don't you? I think that's fair to say. And then it's off into the Labour Party, and then you're kind of a social democratic leader, and now you're very respectable and driving a Vespa around Sydney, which is a pretty insane thing to do, but very courageous. So what's your own development there from the background that you had through your university period into your time in politics and then beyond?
Well, thank you, Jared. I do have a whole chapter in the book about my childhood, and some of you may have read some of what I've said about it in an excerpt that ran in the Good Weekend. I come from a family of four. I'm the eldest of four, and I think I do subscribe to the theory that where you come in families can, it doesn't have to, but can very much influence you, and certainly with my mother having, you know, three other children very quickly after me, I did take on some of those adult responsibilities of being sort of mum's helper, maybe earlier than I would have otherwise. I noticed, and my father struggled his whole life with very serious alcoholism, which is a dangerous, uncertain and ever-shifting world for a child to grow up in. And, you know, when I referred earlier to adversity, I don't think for 1 minute that it's a good thing to set out to make your child's lives miserable, but I do think that when you have miserable things in your childhood, they can often be experiences that really build resilience in you. And we can all think of lots of examples of that. There are plenty of other people who've had terrible things happen to them or difficult things happen in their childhoods who do find it hard to live with and find it hard to recover. But for me, I very much felt that that those difficult experiences forged a kind of strength in me that that has never left me. I'm interested to hear Jared talk about the Sisters of Mercy as conservative influence. There is no doubt that on the one hand they were very conservative. We've had our uniforms measured from the knee and all of those things that you know, you would expect happening in the convents of the 1960s and 70s. But on another, you know, with another lens, they were actually quite, what they were doing was quite unusual and almost subversive. You know, in the 1960s, I don't know what it was like in Sydney, but growing up at the Gold Coast in the 1960s, most girls left school when they turned 15, many of them not even completing year 10. There was not a lot of expectation that girls would finish year 12, let alone go on to university. There was not a lot expected of girls, and generally. And the Sisters of Mercy would have none of that. They had, I mean, it was from a very religious framework. If God gave you a gift, then you've got a duty to use it. And they really hammered into us that you had to be the best that you could be. And as I said, there weren't many other influences in the lives of young girls in at that time that did that. And I, you know, owe the Sisters of Mercy a great debt for drilling into me that that wanting to strive for excellence, that belief that being a girl didn't mean that I couldn't succeed, and as I said, almost a subversive. I don't know that they want to hear themselves being described as subversives, but as I said, there were very few, if any, other forces in the 1960s that were giving those messages to girls and young women. And even just the example that they set, here were, you know, it wasn't easy, I think, being sent out, as most of them were, from Ireland, away from their families, and then living in very often quite lonely and harsh conditions, let alone teaching classes as they had. I've got photos of classes where we had 40 in the classroom. But they were nevertheless examples of strong women. They ran the school. They had jobs. They went to work every day. They were opinionated. They were smart. They, you know, that they were, and I do say in the book there was a period of time that because of all of that I thought I might become a nun, but that didn't last, Jared. And so, without doubt, for me, the Catholic Church in the 1960s was an organisation going through substantial reform. Vatican II was very much the order of the day in the church that I attended, and it was very much a church and an institution that was focusing on social justice, on its role in creating a more equal and just society. And that, without any shadow of a doubt, influenced my political beliefs. I'm no longer a practicing Catholic. I've had my own arguments with the church on other matters, but the fundamentals that I was taught in that Catholic framework have informed my political beliefs, my moral values, and have been very important in forming me as a person. And but then I went on to university. In the late 1970s, I think it's fair to say that most of the campuses around the country were starting to become slightly more conservative places. But that was not true in Queensland. In Queensland, we were in the midst of the Bjelke-Petersen years. And as you would probably all remember, Joe Bjelke-Petersen was a very controversial leader. And he almost seemed to make a bit of sport out of, you know, poking a hot stick into the eyes of young students and you know, young radicals at the time. And so things like banning street marches was red rag to a bull. Had to go and organise them, and, you know, to show up the ban. And so it was a very volatile political environment, and a lot of young people who I think may not, in other circumstances, become involved in those bigger issues certainly did in Queensland in those late years of the 1970s and early 1980s, because they were in a much more extreme political environment than the rest of the country. And I certainly am a product of those times, and I think my view is that many of the things that I took on or tackled or dealt with as Premier were informed by my experience as a young person growing up in a state like Queensland was at that time. And if you like to think of the sort of arc of the Goss government and then the Beattie government and then the Bligh government, we each in our own way saw our central mission was to modernise and transform Queensland, to bring it into the 21st century, to create the sort of place, to create the sort of economy and create the sort of society that other people in other states of Australia had taken for granted for a long time. And you'll certainly see that in some of the things that I tackled.
Thanks. Before calling the next question, I should say thanks to King & Wood Mellisons, the legal firm, for the use of this great facility this evening. So Anne's got one microphone down the back and I've got one up the front. So where do we go? There's a question here. Yeah, don't stand in front of the camera, please. Okay, that's fine.
Hello, Anne. It's been very interesting to hear. I haven't read your book, but there's one question. There's a lot of criticism about in modern politics about the obsession with polls as defining where a leader should take a state or a country on certain issues. There's some notable differences, I suppose. Troops in Iraq, polls would have said overwhelmingly not to go, but both political parties took a different view. I'm just wondering, in the tension in a democracy between leadership and followership, and we often see too much followership, where do you think we are sitting at the moment? Are leaders really being courageous and taking the community with them, or are they too bound
okay.
by
polls? Right. So the question is, are you or were you poll driven, and what about others?
Look, it's a really interesting question. I think any political leader you had up here and put that question to would tell you they'd like to think that they're not poll driven. But I have to say it often feels like an avalanche when it's all, you know, when there's a very, very strong view in the electorate, it does feel like a tidal wave that's irresistible. But I was always equally conscious that while the electorate does want to see you change your mind on things from time to time, to admit when perhaps you've got it wrong, they don't want a leader who flip-flops on everything. And there are some things on which you do have to sort of, you know, land the flag and stick with it. There were many of those where I did, you know, put a stake in the ground and stick with it and gained a reputation for strength as a result. And they were often things that people were uncertain of or unpopular at the time, but with enough time, actually saw that it was an improvement and were okay with living with it, if you like. There were others which were spectacularly, you know, the reverse of that, like the decision that we should sell Queensland Rail, Coal and Freight Division. It does feel like an irresistible force. It is also something which is, you know, growing and growing and growing in magnitude. I don't know when, for example, news polls started polling the Prime Minister monthly, but that certainly never used to be the case. It was probably much more likely, you know, after the budget and then maybe before Christmas or after Christmas. And so you actually would get perhaps 6 months of doing some interesting or difficult things before, and the electorate could see them in practice before they made a final judgment on them. And I do worry that the force of that, while on the one hand is democratising, is perhaps making it very or narrowing the political environment.
Question here.
Thank you, Anne. My question is about the 24-hour news cycle and the ability to have sound bites. I know there's some reporters here tonight, so I'll be polite. But, you know, nowadays you have to say one line and it makes the news. So how does that change how you speak to people about your policies and ideas?
Well, Twitter helps, you know, it helps you care. You know, it's interesting. One of the things that really struck me during the floods was every one of those press conferences was being shown live, and they were often 40 minutes long, and there were lots of questions about often quite complex things. And because they were every 2 hours, you also had to fill them. You had to actually have something to say. You know, that was most of the time not a problem, but sometimes it meant that you, as we were, able to, if you like, lift the veil a little on the dilemmas that we were facing in making decisions. So you might recall, for example, we had to decide whether or not we were going to blow up the floating walkway, which was a very dramatic thing to do. And we had Navy divers out there checking the foundations and working out what sort of explosives would be needed. And And that is not something you get to do very often in government, sort of lift the veil and say, look, we have to make a decision about this, and this is what we're thinking of, and this is why we might and why we won't. And people were fascinated and intrigued and felt, I think, more part of the decision making. I had lots and lots of commentary, and lots of people talk to me about, you know, how they, and there was lots of media comments, well, not media comments, but Twitter and Facebook and all those comments about, they couldn't believe that I was facing 40 minutes of questions and was able to answer them all. And finally, one of the journalists sort of went into the conversation and said, she does that every day. You just don't see it. You see the 60 seconds we decide you should see. You know, and so that was a very interesting experience to actually have the entire ability to talk about deep and complex and difficult things. And it really struck me how rarely that happens. It is not only the 24-hour news cycle that is the problem, is a problem. I think it is a problem. It is very hard for you as voters and constituents and citizens to really understand what the Premier or a Minister or the Prime Minister is doing when they have to say it in 60 or 90 seconds. When you really do get to understand it more is when you, as used to happen, it's changed so quickly. When I was first elected in 1995, every state of Australia not only had its own local 7:30 report equivalent, but the commercial television stations ran current affairs programs that actually ran politics as current affairs. And every single week, the Premier, a couple of ministers would have to go live into a television station and spend 10 or 12 minutes being questioned live on television. And there is nothing like a 10 to 12 minute live interview for you to make, for, you know, constituents to see very clearly either this person's an idiot and doesn't know what they're doing, or, oh, now I get it, now I understand why you want to go down that path. There are very few opportunities for that to happen anymore. You think how many times you ever see the Premier or any of the state ministers in that circumstance. It almost never happens, except perhaps on radio, but generally on things like drive time when many people are at work. Without that ability to have depth and complexity, it becomes, going back to the previous question, it is becoming much, much harder for politicians and leaders to have political discussions. But I don't think it's going to change. So, in fact, the institutions of our democracy and the people who are in it are going to have to learn how to do this better or differently, to actually use the technology in ways that we're currently not using it. I think, by, you know, overwhelmingly, all of that social media and technology is a good thing for democracy. It is actually democratising further, but it is disrupting, as it has in major other industries. And as is the case when it happens in other industries, the institutions are slow to catch up, and we're in this interregnum where I don't think, and I include myself in this, it's not a criticism of the current incumbents anywhere, we still haven't, I think, really caught up with how we could be using this in a much more powerful way to have those deep and complex discussions.
Yes, I was just wondering if you could give us your reflections on the Royal Commission that followed the floods.
I'd had some experience with commissions of inquiry before. I don't talk about the flood one in the book, but I do talk about the Ford inquiry. And I think when they are set up for an appropriate purpose, that those sorts of commissions and those sorts of events can be and are very important. They are cathartic. They can actually uncover truths and give people opportunities to speak in ways that the normal administration of justice and public sector would not allow. There was, immediately after the floods, there was a great deal of questioning about whether or not the dam had been operated appropriately and whether or not those people who operated it had done the right thing. And I felt very strongly that you could not let those questions go unanswered. You couldn't have those sorts of doubts circulating as people live, you know, or in the path of that dam. They had to know. We had to know the answer to that. And I was not in a position to know it. I'd been there, and as the dam engineers, had advised government. But to really understand whether that advice had been the best it could possibly be, you needed to bring in people who weren't involved in the decision, who were similarly trained with similar levels of expertise. So So I do think it was a very important thing to do. I do think everybody who operates a dam anywhere in Australia has probably a much better understanding of the sort of public scrutiny that will be on them. I do think that it's very hard for me to be objective about it because I was there in the extreme moments when I saw what I thought I saw was those people acting with goodwill and to the absolute best of their ability. The commission found that they had acted appropriately. As you know, they then found that perhaps they hadn't been honest about some of that subsequently, but the DPP found that there was absolutely no evidence of that. So, I think some of that got in the way, unfortunately, of really giving the public a chance to understand how does this dam work? You know, when the dam was built, it was built after the 74 floods, and this mythology arose that we will never flood again because the dam would stop the flood. The dam is a flood mitigation dam, and it did mitigate the flood. If it hadn't been there, the effect on Brisbane would have been, you know, considerably more catastrophic. But it cannot stop that amount of water. No dam can. And I think that has been probably a very important learning for people who live in that catchment.
There's a question here, and then take one down the back here.
Thank you, Anna. This may be a bit of a bridge for you, but do you think Campbell Newman's loss of government was more to do with the volatility of modern-day politics or the controversial acts that he, decision-making for that he did in his term of government?
Look, I have studiously avoided being a commentator on Queensland politics, and I'm sure you're very interested in my views. But I think I might pass on that one. I think when you leave the stage, you leave those people who succeed you, whether they're your side of politics or not. I think the Queensland electorate, made their choice and made it as they did with me, you know, decisively. The only thing I will say, and it's not about Campbell Newman or his government, it's important to understand that Queensland doesn't have an upper house. And that means that when there is a big swing against a government, there isn't a handbrake on that swing. It the effects of it on the size of the government majority are more pronounced than they are in other states where you have half of the upper house who don't face the election. And that means that while you can have big swings, you often don't get quite the effect on a government majority. So I think there is a little bit of structural, a bit of structural thing to understand. When Queensland swings, it swings big, but it also has an effect on the government's majority or the government's loss in a slightly different way.
Question here.
I'm interested in your transition into the not-for-profit sector after your life in Brisbane. What's it like reporting to a board and responsible for fundraising and program implementation? What's that transition like? What's it been like for you?
I started my working life before I entered politics, after I left university, in the not-for-profit community sector. My first job out of university was working in a women's refuge, working with children whose mothers had fled a violent circumstance, and went on to do other things in that sector. So when I left politics, it seemed to me a sort of full circle, if you like, to go back to where I had originally started my working life. I'm thoroughly enjoying. It's 30 years since I've worked, or 25, 26 years since I've worked in the sector. It has become a significantly larger player in the Australian context. It is now that sort of third sector, if you like, with all sides of government, all sides of politics in government looking to outsource some of the functions that were once the sole responsibility of government into that third sector. It is becoming a larger sector, and with that size has come a significantly increased capability. So the quality and calibre of boards, not just in my organisation but across the sector, are substantially different to those that I worked with 25 or 26 years ago, where you ended up as president of an organisation if you didn't come to the meeting. Nowadays, very much most of the larger, mid-size and large charities and not-for-profits, very much take the responsibility of their filling their board positions with high calibre, capable people very seriously. And you've got some of the brightest, best minds out of, the corporate sector, the academic sector, sitting on those boards, and it really does make a difference to the organisation. You know, it's not an easy thing to transition out of politics. There isn't any clear path, and it's not the sort of thing you can give much, if any, thought to. If you're thinking about what you're going to do next while you're sitting at the Premier's desk, then you're not doing the job. And it's not the sort of thing you can go and start putting feelers out about and having a chat with people about either. So, you know, for I think most people who leave, even if you know that that's the most likely outcome of the election, you're still left with a very big question mark about where do I go next. And for me, it increasingly felt like the most, not only the natural place, but the place where I could best use the skills and experience and networks that I had gained in public life. And I'd gained all of those, as everyone does, at public expense. And I felt I should put them back into somewhere where they would make the biggest difference. I love the YWCA. It's a wonderful organisation. It is doing terrific work with women and children and their families in some of the most disadvantaged communities in New South Wales. So I'm very proud of the work they do. And it's been interesting for me to work up to the board instead of, you know, chairing the board. But there's a lot to be said about not working a 24/7 overwhelming life anymore.
Just a final question. You write very honestly about your father in the book, who I think was verbally abusive but didn't physically harm anyone. But it must have been difficult to write it. How do you do that in a memoir without upsetting your siblings? I mean, what do they think about it all? Because it's very insightful, but it must have been difficult to write.
It was a difficult chapter to write. And I felt if I was going to write anything about my childhood, I had to actually write as honestly as I could. Otherwise, I shouldn't write it. And so I spoke to my mother at some length. I should say that my father has passed away. And if he was alive, I'm not sure how I might have managed that and what I would have done with that. But I certainly spoke at length to my mother. She read the chapter before I submitted it to the publishers. If she hadn't felt comfortable, then it wouldn't have been, you know, she wouldn't have. And once she said she thought about it a lot. And in the end, she said she thought that there were a lot more people than we know about who are either personally affected by alcoholism or some other form of addiction, or who's someone that they love, a family member, that it's a much more prevalent experience than we often admit to in Australia, and that these experiences are more common than we think, and that she felt that it was, for her, it was a good thing to put it into the public arena, because a lot of it is really about her experience in a very unhappy marriage. My siblings, I then told them about in broad terms, and they were very relaxed about it. They had the same view that, because most of them have talked to the people in their lives that matter, and there's no sort of secret about it. And as I said earlier, my father actually struggled with his alcoholism. He would often spend long periods not drinking, and then, you know, slowly give in to those terrible cravings. But the times when he was successful in not drinking were the times when he had the support of organisations like Alcoholics Anonymous, where it wasn't swept under the carpet, where it was honestly talked about, where he could be in an environment where everything was, where there was no shame, and where everything could be openly acknowledged. So there is, my observation of his experience was that being open about this does actually help. So that was one of the things that in the end made me feel more comfortable.
Many thanks, Anna Bly.
Thank you.
As I mentioned earlier, Kenneth Grundy's got some copies of Anna Bly's memoirs. They're courageous memoirs, and Anna Bly was a courageous Premier who introduced some important reforms in Queensland, and it's important to bear that in mind. So it's been great to have Ms. Bly back at the Sydney Institute, this time not as a politician, and to hear her account of her story. And I think it's also heartening that not every former politician wants to talk at great length about contemporary politics in their own state or other states or nationally. So I'd like to say tonight to Anna Bly, well done. We'd love to have you back sometime in the future. But for now, thank you and congratulations.
You've You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.